It's a little bit of a DNA change to understand that the world is going to go on without you and with you. Now the question is, with you, what difference can you make?
Let's even work this mental model of about 20 hours of investment in your education every week, which I wholeheartedly agree.
And I wouldn't use the word education. It's a 360
development.
To just upgrade yourself. So for our point of view, we originated as the facilitator, the technology partner, the content creator, the ability to be able to transpose an offline experience into online. She said, one fine day, just come for a drive with me. And I want to show you that there's a big water problem.
Yeah.
And we said, no, but we want to do something in education. She says, you're right. But first you come and see the water problem there. And then we realized that actually we don't solve the water problem. You can't solve the education problem.
You were sharing that, you know, some people play golf for their free time. You make movies in your free time.
So I think it's about the stories that one wants.
Ronnie, welcome. Really looking forward to this conversation. I think when I was going through everything you've done, I think the word was coming to my mind is eternal entrepreneur. You know, in your 50s, you started Upgrad, which is now, you know, one of the largest ed tech, you know, companies in the country, doing really well. I think nearly profitable from what I understand, a unicorn. But, you know, in 50s, when people start to slow down, people think about, you know, being on board position and investors and doing something for impact. You do all of that, and yet you have the energy and passion to build a company, you know, which is really leading the pack in its industry. Let's go all the way back to when you started. I think you've been now building companies for over 4 decades. When you started out, did you have some kind of game plan in mind or vision for yourself, you know, that how your life will unfold and kind of projects will do? Like, how did it span out?
So firstly, look, thank you. I'm looking forward to and really enjoy this conversation, keep it interactive. I think for the first time, somebody used a very different word called eternal entrepreneur rather than serial entrepreneur.
Right.
And I don't like the word serial. I think it sounds like a premeditated approach that you want to move from one thing to another.
And you do things in parallel anyway.
And I think the concurrent, so you can do things consecutively and do it concurrently. And I think when people say I do multiple things, I think I would like to say I do some things concurrently.
Right.
I think some of them are actually connected with each other. And I think I'm half answering your question with that in the first place. But I think, you know, it is a little bit of a myth that at 50 and 60, you want to sit on boards and otherwise sip margaritas off the beach. Because at the end of the day, I think all of us, if you've led an active life in a certain particular manner, I think you want to pursue that. Frankly, today in the 21st century, at any given stage, the amount of things that are happening overall and the opportunities that are happening and the diversities that are happening, you have an opportunity to become 10 years younger every 10 years.
Right.
I think maybe 20 years back, you had an opportunity to be 10 years older every 10 years. So if you ask me, where's my energy coming from? I think it's because the world is changing at such a rapid pace.
Yeah.
And with that, it's not just technology. It's actually the consumer. It's all of us.
Yeah.
We're changing. And because of that, the opportunities that it does. To me, I think the opportunity to be younger every 10 years rather than older every 10 years is what
that's amazing,
in
I
the
think.
Morning.
That's a great phrase to keep in mind. And I, you know, I'm a huge health, fitness, you know, enthusiast. So I totally relate to today. We understand so much about human biology and aging. Lifespans are continuing to increase. And no longer, you know,
it's in everything. It's not just in business. I mean, exactly that. The depth of yoga and its acceptance of mind and peace of mind, the acceptance of balance. Otherwise, it used to be an HR matter of one's work-life balance. But today, when people look at balance, it's a multiplicity of balances that can get you going. You can still be doing an 18-hour day when having a work-life balance. Because the balance for you might be 5 other different things.
Right.
It's not always only how much time did I spend with one person. So I think
I'm going to come back to that, you know, the balance and, you know, maybe if you have yoga in your life. But I want to go back to, you know, just start. You know, when you started your career, Ronnie, you know, I think in '80s you were building companies in entertainment space. What was your vision for yourself? Because the reason I'm saying it, a lot of people in their 20s will be watching this. And, you know, obviously everyone inspired by, you know, everything you've done and continue to do. But Ronnie in his 20s, what was the thought process at that time?
Ronnie in his 20s was naive, was opportunistic. But I think one thing I was very clear about, or two things maybe I was very clear about, is not having a plan B. which means really going after the plan A. And my best example for I can give is the optionality after I managed to convince my parents at that time that I wanted to be an entrepreneur and otherwise very professional run family. My brother's done his PhD. My dad was always been a professional in his job. Was his optionality where he said, okay, if you want to finally do that, why don't you first do an MBA or a chartered accountancy and then do that? And to me, that would have been having a plan B, which means that at the end of 2 years, 3 years, I always had this comfort zone that I could always relapse and go back to what I tanked up on. So I think that I was very clear about. And I think the second one I was very clear, which propelled me, was I'm not great at implementing somebody else's vision. Now, that could have been an early thought for me, but it was an early thought for me. And that's when you feel, it's not like I want to build something of my own. So I think, and if you ask me at that stage, the scary part for my parents was when they asked me, so what exactly do you want to do? I think today everyone says, I have a great idea, or I have a great business, or I have a great this. And my second answer to them was, I'm not quite sure. All I do know is I want to be working for myself. I want to create something. I'm not sure what it was.
Right. So you had clarity about being independent, like doing your own thing. Also, reasonable comfort with risk. You were not afraid of trying something or, you know.
So that's a very important point, because risk can be looked at in two ways, right? And I think today when people are so feeling entitled, the risk is losing out.
Yeah.
My risk was I got nothing to lose.
Right.
So I think risk has to be looked at as in a very, very different way. And today also, today in whatever I'm doing, and yes, I may have a little bit more resources, a little bit more failures behind me, therefore a lot more experiences, but it's still the decision is more about what have I got to lose. So at that stage, my risk was I got nothing to lose. And my parting statement from my parents at that stage when I embarked on that journey is they said, go ahead, but look, if anything comes in your way and you are failing, we can't bail you out. So when you get that sense, any sense of entitlement in your life just disappears.
Right.
And that's a great way to start.
And you knew, as you said, you had no plan B also. So it just,
I think that's quite important. And I know most people think, what do you mean? Because you do in life need plan Bs. Now, I know management school tells you all the time to have plan Bs, and I'm not being facetious about that. What I meant is, the more you have a plan A, actually the intensity with which you try and make it work is much harder.
Yeah. I mean, one way I'll interpret is, you know, the moment you have plan B, some part of your brain is always, you know, in some comfort zone.
The left eye is always looking
at that, right? And especially when the things get tougher, and that's where I think I'm sure it will come out later, which, I mean, you had incredible success, but I'm pretty sure there were, you know,
incredible
lot of lows as well, right? So in those, you know, failure time, if there's a plan B ready for waiting for you.
And look, I would say, I mean, a lot of people ask me today, oh, we're on angel investment, you know, what should I do and what I get? And I said, first, just understand one thing. The failures will come first. The write-offs will come first. The upsides will come
later. That's right. Yeah, because the companies that make it, you know, big, they take 10 to 15 years. But failure happens in the first 2-4 years. So you have, you know, your portfolio starts to go down.
Yeah.
So, you know, see, a lot of people, you know, when, let's say, they start an entrepreneurial journey in 20s or 30s, and sometimes something works big. And there's also, many people choose to, nothing wrong with that, to just keep building that for next, you know, 3-4 decades, become chairman of that company. Sure. But you have, you know, kind of reached the peak, exited, built something again from scratch, you know, reached the peak and multiple times over. So when something's going really well, you know, overcome all the hurdles, things are working. What is the thought process? Like what, you know, propels you to find next thing and go all the way to ground zero to rebuild it?
So firstly, I would say it's not premeditated. Mm. So I would say I wasn't ready to call it a day in media at that particular point in time, but it was serendipitous and opportunistic because I had a great shareholder in Disney. They were on our board. I was active with them. And they popped the question of why don't we put it all together? And I think it made compelling logic. And I think if there are two mottos in which I've lived by in life, one of them is all glory is fleeting, because actually that's a very important, it's quite a loaded statement. And I think the second one from that perspective is there's a big difference between being passionate about what you do and being emotional about what you do. And I think most of us get a little bit more emotional. Mm-hmm. So I think at that stage, it just sounded like the absolute right thing to do. At that stage, did I have a very clear plan? Now, what am I going to do for the next 20 years? Not at all. So I think when you look at that, and you know, when I exited, I would say it was not a good word. It was definitely, the word was abandon, not exit. I think maybe when people like you and Flipkart and everyone else actually created value and started selling, everyone became aspirational. At that time, I was walking out on people kind of situation. But so that's one part. Yeah. The reason why you finish a particular thing, it's not premeditated. Actually, if it's premeditated, mm-hmm. you're in trouble.
Right.
Because if you're really going to create value, if you're only going to create value if somebody else comes to you. If you're going to somebody else to exit,
yeah.
it doesn't work that way. So I think that's the big nuance in terms of that. The fact of starting all over yeah. again, that's a DNA thing for mm-hmm. each one individually for what we want to do. And I would say for that 1 year after I moved out of yeah. media and entertainment totally, because there was a mm-hmm. 2 year transition mm-hmm. where I looked at the combined thing. I did a few investments, mm-hmm. and very good ones, and very happy with that work with entrepreneurs. But again, the flashback of 20 mm-hmm. years back when I asked the same question myself, I'm not good at implementing somebody mm-hmm. else's vision.
Right.
So to me, the excitement of just being an investor and talking to entrepreneurs, if they took 4 or 5 of my ideas, that I would be worried because
right.
we're backing that person's right. vision. So while that's exciting, to me, it was not totally gratifying
right.
to be a catalyst. I think I wanted to roll up my sleeves and lead something of my own. In the business that I run, I actually work very well as a catalyst.
Right.
So I would say the reason one went through and created something at scale in media,
yeah.
because media can be something where you can be easily sucked into the creative process or this process yeah. or sales process. So I think my role as a CEO and a founder was being a catalyst.
Yeah.
But when I get to the investment part, it didn't interest me.
Got it. Now I can see a lot of parallel. I think I agree with you that you can't build something with the intention of exiting because, like for example, for me personally, Myntra, there was never a plan to exit. At some point, stars aligned in a way where, merger with Flipkart was the best possible thing to do.
Stars are aligned, serendipity, opportunity. Right. Those are the only ways to do. I think if anyone is looking at a premeditated yeah. move, the biggest flaw is I'd be confused. Who am I building this company for? Because you're building it as per your vision.
Right. That's right.
But if you start planning an exit, you yeah. have to start actually become a third mm-hmm. person and say, who am I building it for?
Right.
Then you look at a target person who's going to acquire you yeah. and building for that. It's a right royal mess.
Yeah, I think both of us are agreeing to the fact. I think a lot of entrepreneurs also watch, this podcast is when you're building it, you have to believe that you're building for the rest of your life.
Absolutely.
Anything else happens, that happens. But you can't think of, this whole idea of flipping it 5 years, 7 years. Yeah.
Position things differently. Right. But I think if anyone's setting out with a timetable, it's a disaster.
Right. Which, you would have seen now this timetable thing, is interesting. This whole venture industry works on fixed timeline. You've also, built a fund also along the way. And so company building is a very long process, while the people you raise money from, they have a very finite exit window. What are your thoughts on that? At some level, access to capital is great.
But that's the ecosystem. That is the ecosystem because the what you would call the funding ecosystem versus the strategic ecosystem is one which will always have a calendar because everyone needs a return.
Yeah.
So I think actually that's a good healthy mix because it forces you to have a timetable and a churn.
Right.
It's a little bit like at some stage, some of even your best executives, they might be, you'll have to move them into a completely different thing or move for some change.
Yeah.
So I think a change in that is on your cap table is nothing wrong with that. It actually puts a little bit of good positive pressure on you. And if you are well planned, you're not looking at therefore changing the course of the company.
Uh-huh.
You're looking at bringing in somebody new for somebody who wants to exit.
Uh-huh.
So the optionalities out there are pretty there. So I don't think because somebody's coming in with a 7-year window that should psych you.
Mm-hmm.
You have to go out and build what you want to build.
Yeah.
The probability in that period of having a secondary market is fair. And if it's not, people will wait.
Right.
But in 7 years, if you have not found other people who are equally interested in your company, then there's something wrong with you.
Right. Fair. So you're saying, there are different set of investors who are interested in different stages of company, different risk-reward profile.
Yeah.
And therefore, it's just maybe investors are, kind of temporary passenger on the bus, but you are the one who are kind of building for long.
Yeah. And temporary should not be used as a loose word because actually 7 years...
is fairly...
there's a reason why everyone says 7-year age also, right?
Right. Fair. I'm going to go back to your risk study again because, I personally also, I've gone through the journey and just after Flipkart, when I started CureFit, it was so painful for 6 months, because from the 5,000 people organization, you are down to 5 people organization and nothing will move, everyone look at
me. Everything comes back to you.
And I'm again going through a kind of similar transition now. It's not not pretty. I mean, partly I also enjoy. That's why I'm doing it. It's not forced. So how was your experience in going back to early stage, you know, and just doing things with your own hands, you know, first 12-20
That's candidly a mixed one.
Yeah.
Because it is true that when you want to do 0 to 1 all over again, the at least 50% of the things are tasks that you've already done before.
Yeah.
And it's not challenging.
Yeah.
And you're not learning anything more.
Right.
But that's your choice of 0 to 1 because there are lots of challenges if you take something from 5 to 10 because you don't know what happened in the 0 to 5. Yeah. So you might be spending a lot more time solving other people's problems there also. But I do agree. I think sometimes it works because if you get co-founders, then you balance on what you think you're good at and somebody else is good at. Or you quickly build a team around the things that, you know, these things I don't want to do as a task. It doesn't work out on timetable, but it more or less gives you that balance.
Right. You know, I think after UTV and before UpGrad, you were running these Unilaser Ventures. And I think you did some incredible, you know, investment. I think, you know, some of them exceedingly well. So, which means you were able to bet on the right people, probably gave, you know, right inputs as well. What are your takeaways? What was your learning about who makes, in your eyes, who is a good entrepreneur? What traits? Because you have limited time to decide, you know, whether who to invest behind. So what are some of the key things that you were, you know, looking for when you were betting on people?
Yeah. I have to say, amongst anything else that I've done from media to UpGrad to our not-for-profit foundation, I wouldn't consider me wearing an investor hat being my strongest link. So it's been a lot more intuitive. But I've looked at it not wearing an investor hat on, but wearing an entrepreneur hat on. And maybe I think that gave me that differentiator to just spot people where one could see in the DNA of your own versus the normal conventional way of first understanding how large is the addressable market, therefore what's the consumer price, what's the price sensitivity, what can happen here, what's the window, what's the competitive landscape. So I think, you know, maybe 5 years, 10 years back, I would look for problem solvers and people with the right attitude as entrepreneurs. But today I would look for problem spotters. Mm-hmm. I think nobody's got time to solve problems. You have to either spot a problem and actually preempt it, because by the time you solve a problem, somebody else has overtaken you. So I think that, and for me, I think that sense of what I would call hyperness that stays with, there is some sense of a tentativeness, a tenuousness in an entrepreneur that I think, for me, that energy is very important, where you're edgy to an extent that you are constantly a little bit on that process where it keeps you nimble. It keeps you very open-minded.
Yeah.
So I think attitude, approach, open-mindedness is very, very, very critical because you're going to go through lots of ups and downs. And how you deal with them and how do you retain that is going to be quite important.
Right.
I think the other one is also, if you're coming in, people need to respect the ecosystem. A lot of people think this is mine. And they talk in the first person, and then everyone else is a periphery in the support structure. That doesn't work. If the minute you're not 100% shareholder of your company, it stops being your company.
Yeah.
You're a shareholder, and you're a founder or CEO. So I think seeing DNA of people there also segregates, because that means that they'll be open to feedback, they'll be open to learn, and the ecosystem will change. Now, I think those were elements for me, but again, with full caveat that amongst all of what I think I've done, this is not something that I've really spent that much time.
And yet it has done very well. I mean, Lenskart is, you know, one of your portfolio companies, the others.
So worked out really well.
Right.
And there were a couple of others. I did something in Agri and one or two others. Three or four of them really worked out very well. Lenskart obviously worked out exceptionally well because it's a very early stage.
But you are kind of alluded to that, you know, dilemma that if you're working with investing behind really good founders, they probably don't need too much input and nudge from you. If they need a lot of inputs from you, that's probably right.
That's a worrisome.
Yeah.
That's worrisome. Because it's your job to back somebody else's vision. And then you go back them, then you can ask them some hard questions. And I think what I would bring to the table was more empathy for entrepreneurship rather than when's your next fundraise, when's your next secondary, what do we do here? So that narrative would be different. I would say I never was a board member in any of my investee companies, still don't. And I don't necessarily attend the board meeting, not because I think those are necessary and important, but the value add I can do at those is very different from what happens at a board meeting.
Right, fair. So you have a more like one-on-one in-depth discussion and have a, you know...
Because that's my strength. I can put myself in that person's shoes. I can we can narrate and work with that. I think that that's a much more different value add.
Right. And entrepreneurs are also able to probably able to relate to you as an operator, right? Because you've been in the same situation.
And you need to open up, right? Because like if they're trying to position themselves, and I think with an investor, there's an element where I'm not saying you're being non-transparent, but you're positioning the entire thought process. You're not talking about your deepest problems and deepest challenges, because the last thing you want to do is have them walk all over you, because now you've done full disclosure.
Right.
That doesn't mean you should not do the right disclosures, but I'm saying what's going on in your mind, the soft issues, is where I think I've enjoyed my interaction.
And I think, would you agree that in the, especially early part, you know, it's also mind game in the head of the entrepreneur, because so much goes on, you know, you have sometimes even self-esteem issues, you have founder dynamic issues, you know, you are trying to second guess what investors want. Maybe things are not working, and just so much, you know, in the, gets so confused in our own head, right? Yes, so do you see that, you know?
There's a lot of contradictions, lots and lots of contradictions. And I think that's a good place, because I would say one dealt with that for the first 20 years. So I can totally, totally relate to the fact of the crossroads.
Right.
And actually pose questions to that person that says, it's almost the person would say, how did you know? And I'm saying, no, I didn't know. I just know that in a situation like this, this is how it would be.
So, zooming out, you know, you've been, you know, this company building experience in many different domains over a long period of time, including working with some of the other entrepreneurs, etc. So, you've been a kind of both participant, significant participant in the whole, you know, entrepreneur ecosystem in India, which in many ways has come of age.
Yeah.
So, what, and I think when back when you started, there was no ecosystem to speak of. I can't even imagine in the 80s and 90s what was it like to try to build a company in the country, right? But what's your sense of, you know, where we are in this ecosystem? You know, what do you like about it? What still needs to get better for just, you know, entrepreneurs to continue to, you know, in some ways play a significant role in their developers?
I think the enthusiasm is there, and that's fantastic. Mm-hmm. I think the optimism is very good. Mm-hmm. I worry about it because optimism without realism is a big problem. Mm-hmm. Being too realistic can make you conservative. Mm-hmm. But right now, we're a little bit in the optimism stage. And this is not just based on anything to do with fundraising. It's just the normal context here seems to be, we're in a great market. Everything is great. We're going to be this thing and whatever else. So I think optimism with realism is something that I would say is needed. But the some of the issues that I may have faced long time back are totally irrelevant today, right? Where I would say mostly the family pressure, the stigma of being an entrepreneur is very positive. It's a very, very positive aspiration, I think. Television shows, the Prime Minister Startup India program has just brought it out of the closet, so to speak. And I think the funding ecosystem is only done that. And that's the second part. I think when I started off, there was no context of any sense. There were no angels, there was no demons, there was nobody, so to speak. So I think you work in an ecosystem.
Yeah.
But what I learned as a humongous asset for me at that time.
And some of these, you know, these are all mental models or mind state. How does a new aspiring entrepreneur cultivate some of these things, you know, not having sense of entertainment? Because a lot of people might have gone to good colleges, might come from
Because
you
stop reading anything in the media.
Right.
Because when you read everything that happens and talks about in the media, it's very one-sided.
Yeah.
Not for any reason. Mm-hmm. They're doing whatever they're doing. But it's one-sided because always it talks about is funding and investors and whatever else and makes it sound like your badge of honor is only that. But I would say 99 or 100 people here. So don't consume the media.
Right.
Look at some of the other people because they're incredible in the small and medium scale in the SME sector, in many other impact sectors.
Yeah.
There's a lot of people doing incredible work where nobody's looked at it. So it's that 1% that gets the spotlight because you're trying to do something attractive that is going to attract funding and then make you look like a success without having actually built a successful business. Whereas there are 99 others who are actually going about meticulously at their own pace, building what they believe to be long-term successful businesses.
Yeah.
And I think I wish we could shine a light on the 99 because that's happening. So if you ask me today in the ecosystem, a lot more optimism, but a lot less realism, much more sense of entitlement than when I started off.
Yeah.
And that worries me because I think that's going to trip people along the way. And third is I think we're true center stage on the 1% that are doing things in the what we would call glamorous world of what media covers versus the 99 others who are doing some incredible work in India.
No, no, absolutely. And some of these things, I think, you know, some of the aspiring entrepreneurs can consider as a warning or things to avoid. One is, you know, when you start, you know, it doesn't matter what you've done, because this is all going to be about that particular problem and just solving that, you know, right. Past grades or past, you know, accomplishment, including, you know, I mean, when I start a new company, you know, whatever I did in the past, doesn't matter. You know, I may have some resources,
yeah.
But that's another problem, you know, fully fresh. And second, I think India, you're right. There are lots of businesses people have, you know, 50 crore, 100 crore profit business. They build bootstrapped, never raise money, yeah. Like, you know, Zerodha, yeah. Is, you know, one example, yeah. Of that, which is now, you know, pretty well known, but it was not that well known. And there, you know, and many others. So I think, you know, studying those models.
You put some of the injection, take some of the steroids out from here and put those steroids here, it would be a very different business than some of these other people.
Yeah, and maybe that's, you know, some of the advice for some of the even venture guys also. It tends to, you know, just follow one narrative any given time. And maybe, you know, that whole can be also more diversified in going after some of these businesses.
But that narrative is not your narrative, and that's the narrative that's being followed right now. It's not your narrative. It's the investor narrative.
Right.
It's the media narrative.
Yeah.
Based on that, your socials narrative, and therefore the pressure around it is like school kids, right? I mean, you want to compete, and as parents, you want your kid to do well.
Right.
And if you look at that environment, you can call it toxic, you can call it competitive, you can call it whatever else. But today, I think it's similar to that environment. It's too much pressure.
Yeah. But when you follow that narrative, the challenges, narrative also changes. Last 4 years, you know, there was a crypto narrative, and then metaverse narrative, and then D2C narrative. And that changes, but as a founder, you need to believe in that narrative for 10, 20 years, irrespective of, you know, whether investors have. So I think that's probably...
Yeah, and I know, I just, a couple of the other days I was explaining, I said, look, if 10 years back when I was starting in education, I would call it ed.com. Then I call it edtech because tech, and now I'll call it edAI.
Yeah, that's right.
I mean, so these are just nomenclatures, and I follow that. Yeah. None of them actually make sense because you have to do what you want to do.
So let's talk about education, actually. So in 2015, when you started, you know, Upgrad, education, you know, wasn't sexy by any stretch of imagination. You'll be honest, in 2016, I thought about education somewhere. I was not able to figure out a good starting point, as well as, you know, had doubts about the size of market, etc. In terms of organized play. But you spotted something, you know, just what were your motivations? You know, why did you pick? And I mean, you've stayed with this now nearly 9-10 years in that journey and doing incredible. So just we walk me through that, you know, thought process of choosing and also the choices you made. In education, everyone typically goes after, you know, tuition market or exam prep market and so on. But you chose something very unconventional at the time.
So I think first choices was co-founders. And I think, you know, I needed someone who understood this with a lot more depth. So I think, you know, that worked very well and get the right co-founders. Mm-hmm. I think then the vision gets explored from that nature. So I think the ability and the narrative of being in higher education and in with a very clear idea that this is going to be the next 20 years. So the beauty was, and the beauty and the beast, if I were to ask that, was that you couldn't describe what your total addressable market or your TAM was because it's to be discovered. Because how many working professionals are going back to college to study? Zero. So what's your total addressable market? Zero. So that was the opportunity. And I think in media and entertainment, I faced that same part. When I got in there, the definition was not even media and entertainment. It was then called and evolved there. So I think at that stage, the idea was really to be in the market where over a period of the next 20, 30 years, every single person will either need to be a generalist or a specialist or both. Everyone will need to upgrade themselves every 3 to 4 to 5 years in some sense of specialization or topping up in their own. Either as individuals in their career or as corporates wanting to do that. So if you look at that market, and this is not just India, it's around the world. It's even in the Western markets because here we have different benchmarks. In the Western markets, it's 10 times more competitive. The change is 10 times more rapid. So that each one has their own. Vietnam has their own need. India has their own need. China has their own need. US would have their own need. So I think just that opportunity. And education is a bit of a calendar event word, right? Because education, first word that comes to your mind would be curriculum, would be calendar. You know, it's like one of those quiz contests and you say first three words that come to your word is education. So obviously sexy doesn't come with calendar and whatever else. But disrupting a sector like that, not in its form, because I think it's important. A lot of people have shown automobiles in 1920 and automobiles in 2020 and said, look at the change. And everyone looked at a classroom with a bench and said 100 years later. But actually, that's a fact. For another 100 years later, that bench is not going to change.
Right.
Because some sense of basic curriculum mm-hmm. you'll have to follow.
Yeah.
But today, when you look at most people, mm-hmm. 20 years back, when you were doing a curriculum and you asked a professor, they would know what you want to teach because they can see 10 years later what is relevant. Today, I think it's a very different way in which knowledge, mm-hmm. information, skilling is going to get this thing, because you can't predict the 20 years later. Those habits are going to be in every sense, social sense, cultural sense, technology sense, consumer sense, knowledge sense, 20 years later. That is when you're starting to teach, yeah. you're teaching for the forward,
right.
but you need to know the forward. So to me, that was the exciting part of really disrupting a sector
yeah.
where you have to look at trends every 5 years.
Excellent.
And I think for all the failures that we had in media, the times we succeeded mm-hmm. was when we looked at forward-looking trends
right.
and we could be ahead of a trend.
Yeah. So I think you packed a number of, I think, very important lessons, right? One is you're not following the herd. You know, it was not the next, you know, cool thing. It was, again, you know, unconventional choice at that time. Other is also realizing that, you know, the world we are living in is changing very, very fast. And the idea of you get educated once
yeah.
and be done with it for the rest of your life
is gone.
Is obsolete. So then how do you solve it? Like, the colleges are not trying to teach people in their, you know, late 20s, 30s, 40s. And that's, I think, I agree with you. It's a huge imperative. You know, today, anyone who is not learning actively is being just left behind. You know,
yep.
there is just, you will become obsolete, you know, like yep. a modern day dinosaur in some ways.
They're not employable. They're really not employable.
Yeah, yeah. But look, it's also very hard, say, when people in their, you know, again, you know, late 20s, 30s, they start to have a family, you know, they have financial commitments, maybe young kids to take care of. What is your advice to people to, you know, what's a good rule of thumb to how much time one should find to keep reinvesting in your, you know, upgrading your skills and learning? Because otherwise, slowly you are getting obsolete, you know, whatever your reason of not finding a time may be. Like, how should one think of a modern professional? Like,
I would just say you don't have a choice, because you really don't have a choice. Yeah. The question of job security, mm-hmm. maybe in government, there's job security yeah. around the world. And mm-hmm. that's 25% of the largest employer in the world is mm-hmm. the government. But if you take the government out of there,
yeah.
there are no job guarantees mm-hmm. today. So actually, in being in a job is as risky as being an entrepreneur, mm-hmm. because right. there are no guarantees in both. Mm-hmm. It's not a lottery either which way, but it's not a guarantee.
Yeah, entrepreneurship, at least you're learning a lot of skills.
Yes. So there you're in a little bit in more control of your own destiny yeah. and you can look at your skills and then you can put mm-hmm. that together. So it's exactly that. If you were a person that was running your own entity,
yeah.
you would get specialists. Mm-hmm. But as an individual in your career, you'll have to look at it in that same manner.
Yeah.
Your left brain, somewhere down the line, you will need to be able to be a lot more 360 mm-hmm. today than you have ever been.
Right.
Just being, I'm great at sales, is going to be a cap.
Yeah. Yeah.
If I'm just great at marketing, it is mm-hmm. going to be a crap. You can still be great marketing and creative, but if you haven't understood technology, if you haven't understood how consumers need to be looked at mm-hmm. today, than how you looked at it only with focus groups and
right.
surveys mm-hmm. 5 years back, you're up the wrong way.
Yeah.
Third, if you're not a business adder along with marketing, you're out.
Mm-hmm.
Because the ROIs today on every cost and expenditure yeah. is becoming harder, faster.
And yeah. And
so the 360-degree approach is really what people need
right.
to be.
So what would you advise? How much time, let's say someone, let's focus on somebody in the 30s, where you know, you've got 10, 15-year career behind you. How much time on a weekly basis or monthly basis you should spend in just continuous upgrading yourself?
I think 20% of your waking 20% of your waking life. And it does not mean it needs to be formatted.
Mm-hmm.
But formatted or unformatted, whichever way you want to.
And let me make sure you're using waking life deliberately, not working life, because 8 hours yes. versus 16 hours.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
So almost yes. like 3 hours.
Not accounting, because working life is a very subjective
point right.
for a lot
so
of
people. So let me do the math, right? You know, 16 hours, let's say. I think most people should sleep 7 to 8 hours. So 16 hours, you know, 20% of that is 3 hours a day. Over 7 is 20 hours. So 20 hours a week, ballpark, yeah. is the investment.
I would negotiate to 17 hours.
Right.
Your 16 hours, I would say 17 hours. 7 hours is also good.
Right.
But yeah, 20% of that, exactly.
7 hours works, you know, if you have like good meditation routine and somehow yeah. you get a very high quality sleep, sure, yeah.
But excuse me, I'm telling you, today, meditation is part of the whole knowledge curve.
Mm.
So I think if you look at that as not part of the 20%,
yeah.
I would count it in the 20%.
Fair. Yeah.
Because internalizing
right.
is also learning.
Right.
Because you will get 40 questions answered mm-hmm. with 1 hour of silence
yeah.
that may save you a lot of time and trouble about mm-hmm. five other career moves you haven't been wasted to take because you're worried about something else.
Yeah, I think this is one. I think you're. I think Ronnie's very, very important message. So I want to dwell more on this. Let's see, work this mental model of about 20 hours of investment in your education every week, which I wholeheartedly agree.
And I wouldn't use the word education. It's a 360
development. Yeah,
just upgrade yourself.
Upgrade yourself, which may be about your brain, about your body, about the knowledge, about the skills.
Because it's connected, not because your body is different and your brain is different. It's all connected.
Yeah, so you're continuously upgrading yourself and you have to find that time. And most people today may not be even spending, for a lot of people, the account may be zero. So maybe one, anyone who's listening to this, I'll advise that just do a mental calculation of last 10 weeks. What is your average? Is it zero? Is it 10? Is it 20? If it is anything, in single digits, then you are in trouble. Like you have to really start thinking about changing your life.
Yeah, I would say that. Do the maths, but also do the segregation of which was the highest ROIs and even your downtime of what you want to do. Because I think we need to disregard, it's not just the formal learning of that. You're challenging yourself, your clarity of thought, just getting, simplifying things sometimes in your decision-making process is upgrading yourself.
Right.
Because I think we complicate too many matters. Then we get into multitasking. Mm-hmm. Then there's this entire world of distraction. Mm-hmm. And before if you're talking about 2 hours, your distraction, minimum distraction levels today are 2 hours a day.
Yeah.
Imagine if you trade your 2 hours of distraction, which actually doesn't really get you going.
Yeah.
It really does. Because I asked you to remember how many of your Instagrams or news or this or that you consume that you retain, very low.
Yeah. So that means part of this 20 hours means you need to have some completely distraction-free time as well, where you are with your own thoughts, with maybe pen and pencil or just think it through and clarify.
Or go for a run or go for a swim and come up back with that. Whatever. So one is the approach and technique of that balance of mind to simplify your life, to prioritize it. I think today it is true that when most people say I can fail, but nobody can take away my knowledge. Mm-hmm. It's a fair statement. Yeah. But today I think you need to be smart and not just intelligent.
But knowledge is getting obsolete.
I think today if you're only intelligent and not smart, it's not good enough.
Yeah. And also, what does even intelligence mean? Today now we are going to be in some ways co-living with all these AI tools. So that my intelligence is not only mine, but also what I'm able to use and what I'm able to do with that, right? So it's also not
true.
Just one definite.
I'm not making too much of AI, and it is definitely a tool that's going to completely disrupt in many ways, but not as the level at which I think people are saying they will disrupt today. But you know how to handle these situations here. Because I think one of the dangers in this pressure life of ours is the what I would call the mental toll it takes. And I think that's an important message, at least I would like to communicate, because of that, you get into such a whirlwind on your balance of time that sometimes you compartmentalize yourself, and that actually adds to the stress. Right. And then the second one is your mental health is very important, because if you start feeling low in your self-esteem, that 20 hours will feel like 80 hours. But if you're not and you have that self-confidence and simplicity, even if you do 4 hours, it'll feel like 20 hours. So I think today we have to watch out, because a lot of the younger generation decides to feel defeated or low or depressed very soon.
So let's just talk about what can people do. Partly I'm getting right is, bit of it's just about eliminating things. You just can't just
eliminate what other people think of you. Just eliminate that.
That's right.
And eliminate distractions.
Yeah.
You can eliminate these two things.
Right.
I think that's a phenomenal starting point. Yeah. It's like losing 8 kilos overnight.
Right. Yeah. Earlier, I came across this, these days, we hear a lot about this FOMO, fear of missing out. I came across this, joy of missing out.
Yeah.
Like, a little bit if people are able to incorporate that. Yeah. I really, personally, I just share with you, Ronnie, is I'm not recommending it's a great thing to do, but I've stopped going out for evening events. I don't go. Like, people stop inviting me also. Yeah. But that frees up my evening, I can use it how.
It's your personal choice. Right. And that's what you've done it.
Right.
It was very good when it happened.
Right.
And now you have a different ROI on your time.
That's right. Yeah. So, one is that part, which is investment in personal growth. I'm still been after 20 hours. But what else people can do? Like, what are your advice and kind of things one can do in terms of, courses, reading, mentors? Like, just one broad set of tools one can consider adopting to leverage that 20 hours well.
Yeah. I think this one sense is definitely to step out of your comfort zone. Because a lot of people, part of the situation today is acceptance. Do we accept that we need to do something different? And if you can, most people stop at acceptance. you have to cross that bridge of acceptance. Yeah. I think once you do, you'll find your own, whether it's a podcast, it's a combination of things, right? I mean, people will pick up three things from this podcast and come up with three points. It might be a 1 hour podcast, but if 3 minutes of that was relevant for them, that's good. So when people ask me about books, I say I read chapters, not books, because I think sometimes you just glean one or two things from a book. I don't think I've totally read a book in a long time, unless it's fiction, because otherwise we still need to read half a book with this fiction. But in nonfiction, it's chapters, it's nuggets, it's lines, is what you want to do.
Right.
So I think, absorbing to an extent of being curious enough to actually be out there in the market. That doesn't mean you need to socialize. Right. So I agree with you. I'm as reclusive a person as the next person, even though it sounds quite different because I'm coming from media and entertainment. Right. The assumption is, how can you be reclusive and be in a sector like that?
Yeah, I'm imagining all these Bollywood parties that you host.
Exactly. So that's far from it. But I think when you're out there and you're constantly looking to seek, so there's a lot of that simplicity part that goes in there. But to me also, the internalizing has helped a lot.
Yeah.
So I think, and there's no age for that. Like most people today, when I'm doing a lot in the philanthropy space or in the giving back space, and everyone says, okay, but that's fine. Now you started. And when did you start? I'm saying, no, I started that 35 years ago. Because there's no right time to figure out what you need to do. Today's 35-year-old is thinking very differently than when I was 35. There's no question about that.
Right.
Like light years differently. Not better, not worse, but differently. So find your own DNA on that. And you need to be highly... And I think, again, I go back to, if you've got a sense of entitlement, if you can't accept what you've got, those are problems that then you can spend 20 hours reading, nothing will get solved. So it's a little bit of a DNA change to understand that the world is going to go on without you and with you. Now, the question is, with you, what difference can you make?
So to your point about, you know, ultimately people should find hopefully three takeaways from this. So I think one is definitely this, you know, you talked about the dropping sense of entitlement. And second, finding time, whatever the 10, 20 hours of an investment in your continuous development. We'll arrive at third point soon. But you've, you know, a couple of times mentioned, you know, mental health. And also a lot of things you're talking about, they're all reflecting some kind of self-awareness. What is your process of, and also your advice to people, like how do I, what can I do to improve my mental health and just develop more your self-awareness?
Yeah, look, it's not easy. I think I came from a lower middle class background. I didn't do too much in education. I didn't have too much of, or didn't have any financial resources. And for me, my soft skills helped me get my self-confidence.
Yeah.
So for me, early days of theater, debates, and doing plays for a hobby, I think gave me the myself of self-confidence.
You were acting?
Yeah. I used to act on stage. I used to do front of camera hosting. I think that part serendipitously got me into media because otherwise, but it gave me my sense of confidence to sit here and have this conversation. Because, so I think each one at that early stage, you have to find your own sense of what I would call self-confidence, self-conviction, because that's the only reservoir you have.
Yeah.
Again, I think, as I said before, we spend a fair amount of time trying to live other people's lives within ourselves.
Yeah.
So I would say that it's not easy to do and from the outside because most of us reflect. But it actually, the tremendous lack of self-confidence is the only reason you would be living based on what you think, how do I want to project myself into the world? Because I think the day of people saying, so... okay, now you're 60. How do you want to be remembered?
Yeah.
You know, what does anyone want to see on your epitaph? And I'm saying, why the hell would I be bothered about what is in my epitaph? I'm here today. After I'm gone, I don't give a damn what is in my epitaph. Today, all I want to be, not remembered, but all I want to do is that like every moment of my life, I live to the fullest and hopefully most of it on my terms.
Yeah.
So if you take that DNA and if you expand that to your different age group, you'll go for it. But go for it because you want to go for it, not because how it appears to other people.
So our third takeaway is that just somehow you figure out a way to not caring what other people think, not living other people's
and
life.
Not caring in a non-empathetic way, but not. But yeah, that kind of influence. I think we're living 50% of our time we spend trying to live other people's views of what we should be.
Right.
Sometimes it could be parents with the best meaning. Sometimes it could be family. Sometimes it's the outside world. The problem is the social media also puts an incredible amount of things.
Yeah.
It's a little bit like I say to all of us when we were school kids, right? That pressure was we were always living the life of different people in the classroom. And then our parents and how they would meet and who they felt they could say, my kid comes first, comes third, or he's great at this, he's great at boxing. That pressure, I think, has to go. And that leads to what I would call the mental stress.
Right. So, Ronnie, you were talking about, you know, how UpGrad started with this insight about that you need to continuously educate yourself to stay relevant in the modern world. And you chose a model of offering basically full-fledged degrees, you know, whether bachelor's degrees, master's degrees in an online format. And, you know, 3-year or 4-year degree program is also fairly expensive. That itself was also quite unconventional because, you know, when you pay that kind of dollar value, you expect to go to a physical campus, sit in a classroom, walk around the campus and so on. So, how were you able to, first of all, make that choice and also, you know, make it work? You know, now, you know, I don't know numbers, but, you know, a huge number of people are able to do their higher education basically online.
Yeah. Well, firstly, I think there's a 100-year-old legacy in industry and an issue with the universities. So they bring incredible amount of credibility to the space, right? Yeah. So for our point of view, we originated as the facilitator, the technology partner, the content creator, the ability to be able to transpose an offline experience into online. Now we can call it content and technology, but at the end of the day, it's a 360-degree approach. So second, I would say is once you're in a job, I think 0.001% of the people can really afford and say, oh, I'm going to take 2 years off and do my MBA. Or I'm going to take 2 years off and upskill myself. So that day is gone. Because today, with no job security also, leaving a job and coming back into the working professional cycle is off. So that's off the table. The third is actually affordability. Because when you're going back, the three things you happen. You're dropping your income. You are relocating to a place of an offline center. So there's always the question of lodging and boarding. If it's not in your place of your choice. And the third is the actual curriculum, please. So if you look at those three elements, that is the problem we were trying to solve for. That as a working professional, there'll always be 0.001% that will have the luxury to be able to upskill themselves. But the other 99.9999% won't even have the opportunity because they have to continue with their job. So how do you create an online experience for exactly what is the same offline experience? In fact, I would say during COVID, it did us a disservice. The K-12 sector had its own hockey stick. Now, I don't know what the stick is. It's a bit of a stick
right.
Was that everyone assumed that, aha, okay, so getting on a Zoom call is really learning. But actually, it is a extremely intricate process. Like one of the most successful paths of online learning today is peer-to-peer learning. So I think what we redefined is that when you're looking at offline, faculty, which is obviously then highly respected, is your core. But today, faculty constitutes 30% of the online learning experience. 70% comes from industry professionals who become faculty. But you and I can take courses on thing, and but we'll always be a guest lecturer. But you are a guest lecturer in the offline space because of the time you can give. But in the online space, you're faculty. So converting, I think when we're looking at solving a problem for India or a country like Vietnam or even in the US, what is the biggest challenge is actually getting that quality of faculty outside of the real estate investment, which people can make. So suddenly you solve the entire faculty approach and you brought in a completely new dimension because there's a certain structured teaching that faculty bring, but there's a completely different structure of learning that industry professionals. So that was our second part there. And third is technology can allow you to do peer-to-peer learning that even a classroom count. Sure, you can in a classroom have an interactive conversation, but actually how many interactive conversations can you have? Because there's a certain level you need to cover a curriculum in there. Here, every time, and if you are what I would call our classes with 600 students, and that would be tough in the offline space. But in the online space, having a 600 class of 600 people is not, the 600 people class is actually much more adventurous, much more participative than the class of 60 people. Because you post a question, five other companions are there. Somebody wants to do a study group. So if you now suddenly start understanding this ecosystem, you can understand that it's not a competition of is online better than offline. It's a question of, I can't afford to take a year off. And I'm getting a very different peer-to-peer learning industry experts experience that I cannot get in the other space. So it's not an either or.
In some ways, you know, it's the best of both worlds, right? I mean, it's one is it's cheaper because you're not relocating, you're not quitting your, you know, everyday income. It's also flexible.
Cheaper. It's much cheaper. And and the, you know, getting out of the professional world. Now, obviously, it's tough. It's tougher than taking a year off because now you've got your personal life And it's mostly at the age when you're forming and your family and your kids are young. And you've got a work life, which is also in the tough stage because you're just about building your career and you're building that.
Yeah.
And now you've got to do this.
So one is this, you know, working professional who are, you know, coming at it from continuous upgrading their skill mindset. But what about people, let's say, who are just starting to think about college, like someone who is 19, 20 year old.
Yeah.
And I know you have enabled access to a lot of international universities also,
yeah,
which one can enroll sitting here. So how should they think about that, you know, in doing a degree through UpGrad versus, let's say, doing a degree in a local college or somewhere in India, which is a physical, you know, four-year campus experience?
It's a good experience, but there are limited seats in every sense of the word. I think this allows you a multiplicity of choice. Mm. Actually, I would say the people who are doing some of our undergrad degrees, 50% of them already work in professions. Mm. Because your socioeconomic reason did not allow you to maybe go in and do that. So maybe from 12th standard, you went and started working. So now you can actually do that. Mm-hmm. We've had an incredible amount of students and come and said, I always wanted to do it from X university or Mumbai University, or Chandigarh University or D.Y. Patil University. And now suddenly they have the optionality to do it without relocating themselves.
Yeah.
And for example, the women, unless you've got a relative in that city, you're not likely to be allowed to be moved to that city.
Uh-huh.
Now you don't have that. So the element of accessibility and a timetable of your choice and your ability to now do it in your life is high.
Yeah.
So at 18, 19, and 20, I'm not recommending, therefore, that if you, it's an either or. Mm-hmm. It's a different experience. If you want to start working, you can do this parallel.
Got it. Let me ask you one, you know, maybe a question which is based on live case. I was just talking to my niece a couple of days ago. She's preparing for JEE, not very confident whether she will get into, and she's not right now, not even clear about other colleges. So, like, now that, you know, keeping UpGrad in mind, what advice can I give her in terms of, you know, what kind of college, university options she can consider as an alternative in case, you know, she doesn't end up going through?
Well, on a lighter note, I would advise you not to give advice to the younger generation.
Fair, okay, all right.
I think it's like, you know, your parents, you're telling them, I guarantee if you marry this girl or this this boy, and you're going to be happy with
Just to be clear, she asked me for advice.
Session, I think you can.
Right.
That here's a multiplicity of choices.
Right.
Finally, it's her choice what she necessarily needs to do. But if she had to map out her next 5 to 10 years, and in that, if she feels like today, when you wanted to get to your post-graduation MBA, 20 years back or 10 years back, it was like you just went into it. Then everyone said, no, maybe 3 years of work experience, then do it.
Right.
So today, I think in the real world, the ability to pick up real experience and contextualize your learning is becoming extremely important.
Yeah.
So whatever you're going to pick up in the formal learning space, if you're actually living life, not as a student also, I think there's a distinct advantage.
Got it. Fair. Just want to also ask you about universities, you know, one would imagine that, you know, college and university are very, in some of the old institutions, and they have a certain way of thinking, which is hard to change.
Yes.
What is the process of convincing them to enabling and opening their entire program to be offered in an online format with the students who may be in the other part of the world? Was that a, you know, difficult journey to convince them? And
so I think in the early days, I have to say that when we went across to the universities, we were talking about doing curriculums that they were not doing. Because the beauty of online is that we are preempting careers of tomorrow.
Yeah.
So I think one of our first university relationships that we had, where we started off data science, they were not doing data science. So to them, it was a plus plus.
Yeah.
So it was interesting to get some of their faculty. Then we said, we're going to get 70% industry professionals. So your thawing can happen for multiple reasons. One is you're not doing what you're doing.
Yeah.
Second, today, almost everyone feels that whatever my real estate will do, some colleges have 10,000 capacity, but most is 800 to 1,900 capacity. But today, when you're solving a problem of scale, and if you want to move out GRE ratios, people are realizing that I can't go and do 4x of CapEx. So I might as well look at options of how my best, my brand, my teaching pedagogy, my faculty, my knowledge, how do I put it into practice and channelize it that more people can actually benefit and I can make it more accessible and affordable. So that penny is dropping very quickly with most people.
Got it. And how are you finding balance between, you know, the way university will offer like their curriculum, way of teaching, way of evaluating students versus, you know, all the infrastructure you have built in terms of augmenting the whole education experience, bringing all this industry professional, like how do you blend the two so that even though I'm getting a degree from Mumbai University or a university in US, yet it's an experience which is designed and managed by
Apple. No, that's a good question. And all I would say is the structure, the design of the curriculum that comes to university is very strong. So your sandbox is well established. Okay. Second is your assessment, your grading, your final exams, your midterm exams. That bottom of the level, what the university does, has been done extremely well. So your ability to rate yourself, grade yourself is a very, very important part. Now, then in between is the technique of teaching and learning and how do you share that. And that, in any case, I think, is getting augmented. Because even in your classroom today, what you taught, if you taught it with the same tonality and the same text and the same textbook of 5 years back, you're not going to hold the attention of your learners.
Right. Got it.
So that's where we bring that complete sense of electricity into the whole.
Got it.
That can make a 2 plus 2 equal 22.
And how is the, in your opinion, how will the nature of education evolve over next 5 to 10 years? You know, we are living this very rapidly accelerating environment.
Yeah.
But also some things also don't change. So that balance of maybe some of the things about education may not change at all in 10 years.
Yes,
but
that's why I'm saying. I think education may not change.
That's much. Okay.
Continuous learning will.
Okay.
And I think we need to segregate the two because there's a certain base camp that can't change because we haven't gone through the base camp. It's like getting into the army without going to the army school or anywhere else or going to any forces or any basic part without training.
Yeah.
So that's elementary and that would stay. Does that need to get augmented to be relevant to the context of today? Yes.
Right.
And that's what I would call the brick and mortar play a very big role, very important role.
Yeah.
But continuous learning should not be mixed up with education, which can't be tinkered with too much.
Right.
But continuous learning has to be 100% flexible.
Got it.
Because continuous learning is different strokes for different folks.
Right. Understood. Continuous learning is more in the context of where you are, in what station of life, what your current challenges and problems and where you would upgrade.
Yeah.
Fundamentally, how people are taught, a lot of the conceptual elements of that are not going to at least change very rapidly.
They shouldn't. Right. They shouldn't. And I think that's the base camp. That's the foundation.
So, which means, in some other way to say very simply, the value of a degree 10 years from now will be, as much as it is, today.
It will be different. It will be base camp. Mm. So, if it was at the top of your CV 30 years back and became the foot that came out middle of yours. Now it might be an important criterion.
Right.
But it's a conversation where people want to know your background. Mm. People want to understand what your background was, where you come from that perspective.
What's your sense of overall in India, in terms of, now look, and maybe a little bit later talk about, India is, poised at a very interesting juncture where, in some ways looks like, most of the stars are aligned for really India to transition from at some point, a poor country to developing country to potentially a developed country next 20, 30 years. And education obviously is going to be critical. So where are we in the overall education infrastructure? Do we have enough colleges, universities, enough seats? You know, on one hand, we talk about the demographic dividend, median age being 28 years and so on.
Yeah.
Which means every year, I think if my numbers are correct, about 1.5 crore people cross the age of 18 every year.
Yeah.
And ideally, you'll want at least half of them to get college degree.
Yeah.
I think today the number is not even
enough. Because right now our ratios are 25%
right.
of the people actually get into college or go into college.
Right.
Actually consume that.
Yeah. So that delta, how does it
get?
Country
needs to be at 50-60%.
So how does that get bridged? What needs to happen? Government.
I think there's not too much that can happen in infrastructure because it may need $200-400 billion, and I don't think anyone's going to put that in because if you want to look at it, and infrastructure alone won't solve it because without that. You need incredibly trained faculty.
Yeah.
So you're not suddenly going to get the world's best teachers to come in here and you don't need them. We're a Vishwaguru here in some ways.
Yeah.
But teaching has never been such an aspirational profession in the past. Today it is. It was in the past. It still is. I believe it is. But I'm saying for a lot of people today moving into this.
Yeah.
So the optionality I'm giving you and almost everybody else to actually, because of technology, be a teacher and contribute to the ecosystem of the faculty is going to be one major part of that.
Right.
I think the second part definitely is whether we like it or not. And I think the government has aligned themselves and accepted that because the new education policy talks about the fact that accepting technology. I mean, today between some of the ministries, they're harnessing artificial intelligence. Mm-hmm. If you take the fintech, would you think the government would have gotten into any of these things in the past? No.
Right,
but because they have from an Aadhaar, which was as basic to now, if you see, the government has done played an incredibly strong foundation mm-hmm. and catalyst role.
Yeah.
The minute you put that, private sector comes in. And of course, there'll be some clashes and some PPP. There are already some frictions and whatever else. But by and large, that's going to build the system. The third one is, I don't think it needs to be as calendarized as everyone makes it out to be. You could be reaching 60%.
Yeah.
It's not that everyone at the age of 18 mm. will have crossed that. And that's the beauty about the system. You can still be a developed world, and you may not do it at 18, maybe at 26 or 27, people would have done that. But today in India, we picked up more working environment experience than you would have in your formal education. Yeah. And there's nothing wrong with that.
Right. And that's outstanding, actually. There's a very different way of looking at things. We want, let's say, at least half the people to get college degree, but they can take next 10, 15 years also. Maybe your socioeconomic situation
maybe a little bit, but in that 7 to 10 year horizon, you could.
Right.
And actually, it's a much more pragmatic way because sometimes you have to pace it.
Yeah.
Right. You have to pace it to set those expectations. Because if you push a system here, there is no system for that. We will not have in the next decade that many trained faculty and that much of realistic.
Mm-hmm.
Today, if you look at even with universities, the aspiration universities are the ones in the right locations. But there are some in smaller locations that are not 100% full.
Yeah.
So when we look at infrastructure also saying it's peaked out, it's not. That way, per seats, there's a lot. But why are they not going there? Partly because of accommodation and whether I go there, it'll be a small town or level of faculty or many other things.
Yeah. Upgrade is one way you are creating, massive impact. But I think, as you earlier mentioned, you've been doing impact only projects also for a long period of time. I think, last time when I met you, the impact that Swadesh is able to do is incredible. So let's talk a bit about, that journey. Like, when did the thought start? I think you mentioned earlier, you've been doing this for 35 years. And where are we now today with Swadesh and the kind of impact you're able to
So in the quick line on that, because I think I've said it more often than not. But I started in my early 20s, both my wife now and whatever else. We were co-founders in the company at that stage. So we started a very early stage. But I would say the first definition for us is in a 10,000 square foot office that we rented. 1,000 square feet we gave to an old age home and a creche and an orphanage. And that actually created the culture because it was the work-life balance for most of our first 30 employees was after 7 o'clock hanging in that 1,000 square feet. And then as it grew. So I would say that took, that DNA was there, that DNA of a balanced approach.
And that thought process was very obvious to you. Because a lot of people think, let me first make money. Once I'm sizable, everything's taken care of, then I'm going to start deploying it here. But you basically, as a start of your career, you said 10% of, that.
Because I got an opportunity to do it without saying, let me first get money. So I think that's why, to that extent. And today, if you ask me, I don't have an explanation of whether that was visionary or preemptive. That's just how it happened.
But you stayed with it throughout your life. It's not like, you started.
I stayed with it for a long time. Then the first employee we had in our foundation came from the rural district of Raigad in Maharashtra. And she said, one fine day, just come for a drive with me. And I want to show you that there's a big water problem.
Yeah.
And we said, no, but we want to do something in education. She says, you're right. But first you come and see the water problem there. And then we realized that actually we don't solve the water problem. You can't solve the education problem because the girl child is walking 4 miles a day. And this is an Indian story. I'm not saying anything today. So that's when the penny dropped on us at that stage, that it needs to be a little bit of a holistic model because the problems that you're trying to solve, sometimes we look at it and say, I'll put all my resources into agriculture or into building a school. Or building a toilet. But the problem is, will the person use a toilet? Because there is a water problem.
Yeah.
And if anyway they feel as a habit, it's not changed, they're not going to use that infrastructure. So I think that was early days. But we couldn't do much about it where we worked with a few villages and worked slowly, slowly on water development. But I think on my first final crossroad of exiting and having my first liquidity event when I sold UTV to Disney, I think that was the time when the crossroad was there because for the first time we had resources. Otherwise, I think I was pretty much on borrowed money. I think my daughter went to school and college based on borrowed money or my learning on my life insurance policy.
Right.
So that was the time when I think the reflection was, what do we now want to do to scale up? So ironically, we decided to scale up.
Yeah.
Ironically, in the first year, when we spent a year and a half re-researching this whole space and trying to figure out what people were doing in models. And one of the realizations was this incredible amount of work happening, volunteering work happening in the country. You know, I think people talk about America being far ahead in philanthropy. They might be giving 1 to 2% of the GDP of their this thing, and ours may be 0.2%. Yeah. But if I look at that, I would say from what I've understood from statistics, 80% of that mm-hmm. goes towards universities yeah. and grants and the church. So that's a different environment yeah. from what it will go to right. here, because there are different environments. Mm-hmm. So I think some of those realizations came to us.
Yeah.
We were very clear we wanted to do an execution foundation. As an entrepreneur, I just felt this was not something that suddenly one wanted to give out, but one wanted to build something in that space.
On a lighter note, if you like solving water problems, you'll probably need to do something for Bangalore, because, you know, we have like severe shortage of water. Like, I'm not kidding you, like the place where I stay, they are now cutting down water for 6 hours. If you can believe, you know, the Silicon Valley of the of India. And
but that's an irony of, we're a first world country, but some of our city planning, yeah. we have to get something going.
It's right in our face every day. You know, I grew up, you know, in very small town, Haridwar, and, you know, there you used to, like, water will come for 6 hours a day.
Yeah.
But in 2024 in Bangalore, yeah. having to relive that is quite something. But, you know, so coming to Swadesh, Ronnie, I think from what I understand, you know, the stated objective is to, you know, build these model villages and try to, you know, bring a lot of people out of poverty, you know, with a very systematic long-term approach. So can you explain, you know, how do you identify this?
Yeah, I'll keep it pretty simple, sure. because it's come through tens and thousands of failures and setbacks mm-hmm. and learnings for us sure. over these last 7-8 years mm-hmm. to get to this model. But at the core of it, it is about empowering the community. Mm-hmm. So with the result that now today we don't enter that unless we follow a village development committee. Mm-hmm. If they don't have a village development committee and there's politics in that village, we'll stay out okay. till they do that.
Yeah.
And we'll see to it that they meet some of the other people mm-hmm. where we made a lot of impact. So they finally realize they need to do
this
that.
This village development committee is a voluntary organization?
It's actually 10 people from that mm-hmm. from that village that appoint a village development committee.
Yeah.
It's like building a board of directors, mm-hmm. if you ask.
Yeah.
Of which at least 50% have to be women. And of the whole 10 people, at least 30% have to be youth yeah. and young people. We can't have old people there.
Yeah.
Now, once they do that, and sometimes it takes a year to build that mm-hmm. village development committee because they've got politics and this yeah. and no, and then we stay out. But that core, they make their 5-year plan and okay. we help them make their 5-year plan. Mm-hmm. Their 5-year plan on basic existential issues like mm-hmm. water and sanitation, yeah. their kids and therefore education and health, mm-hmm. and the third being livelihood. So that's our overall model. We sit down there, build with them, mm-hmm. and then be the catalyst to empower them.
Yeah.
So water and sanitation just gives you your basic infrastructure. Mm-hmm. Health and education mm-hmm. raises your aspiration.
Yeah. Level.
And livelihood makes you control your destiny.
Mm-hmm.
Because frankly, if the head of the family does not mm-hmm. feel that he has control of the destiny of his kids, and if he's only going to be based on government grants,
yeah.
that will never change. So therefore, the focus on livelihood, and we look at an entire geography mm-hmm. in a concentric manner, okay. mini GDP approach,
mm-hmm.
that whatever your infrastructure was. Right. So our idea is to enter a place and try and exit within 8 years,
Got
five,
it.
Six, 7, 8 years, depending on the time period. Because the other thing mm-hmm. we found when we were doing our research was people were doing incredible amount of great work, but doing it for the last 30 years. Yeah. And the first thing that struck me as an entrepreneur, because that's what I would do,
yeah.
what's your ROI on whatever you invest in? I'm saying, but if I've been doing it for 30 years, means obviously I'm not doing something right, because by now somebody else should have taken it over and done it.
Right.
And I think that has given us a lot more laser focus of the baton handing over and the community handing over, which is why if you don't have the village development committee, they're going to take it over.
Uh-huh.
And our job by the second or third year is to see that the government plays an important mm-hmm. part, because the government is very active.
Yeah.
But trust deficit between mm-hmm. community and government for right. historical reasons mm-hmm. has been strong. If you build that,
yeah.
you can't really take this into a permanent structure with the government. So I think it's a formula that we've now done. I think it's a model for rural India.
And what does the model look like? You know, so you say you take 5 to 7 year horizon. If you're able to share, what kind of resources are required in a per village? I'm guessing it varies from population, so for a particular size.
We're working in two different geographies. Yeah. One is about 2,200 villages. Another place, there's 2,000 villages. Total community would be about 1 million people, right? In that whole concentric geography is in there. So water and sanitation are the ones that have the high investment.
Okay. Right.
After that, it's a self-fulfilling, because education is something where we will give the right support, and then we need
to. And is there a clear, you know, and like, you know, entrepreneurs speak, you know, clear success criteria, like after 5 years, yes. the metrics that you look at, which tells you that you covered a significant distance?
Yeah. I mean, you need to have potable drinking water, so that even the people who migrated out feel now I can come back.
Sure.
You need to be open defecation free completely, which is otherwise there's no point of having a toilet, which is attached to you. It's not a communal toilet. In education, our benchmark is clearly that everyone needs to complete a minimum of a 12th standard and 50% have to be first class plus. And those ratios are half that when we started off in that. In health, we focused on key things. I think anemia, malnutrition on one side. The girl child and therefore the mother of minus 9 months to plus 3 years and hand-holding. Eye care, which we take for granted, but actually is very empowering because that's almost your entire self-confidence goes down if your eyesight goes down and you've never gone and checked. These are small aspects.
Right?
So some key parameters in health. And then most important is livelihood. But our goal is whatever is your family income, it should be 4x of that in the next period, in the 3 to 5 to 5 years that are there. Which is not that easy. Because a third of our people don't have an earning member.
Right.
Don't own land. And maybe the son has gone somewhere into the city and gives back a little bit of... So it's a challenging environment. But I think it's a model that we're at it. It's incredibly challenging, but incredibly exciting.
So today, the Swadesh Foundation is, you know, in some ways, you know, doing something to improve the lives of these about a million odd people across these 4,000 villages.
Yeah.
What's your thought process behind it? Is the model at a point where other people can also learn from what you have done and try to replicate in other
people? Like to do that. We haven't put a full process, SOP and a manual to that thought process, but incredible amount of people are coming in there and working with us on that. So we'd like to document and make this into a model which people can follow. There's no question. So that would be, I think, one. The second one is we've now done the empowerment and the catalyst part. Because with the Village Development Committee and the catalyst for the government, we made permanent change. And therefore, we call them dream villages. When we build the dream villages, we kind of exited except for the little finger. We'll always have a little finger there. We will have volunteers that will be there. We have a Swadesh Mitra in each village that is embedded maybe for life. Allows us to give us a report card. If there's something degenerating, that we can come back and hold the VDC and the Village Development Committee responsible.
Well, that's super inspiring. I think that's probably a whole podcast episode by itself. I really hope that other people are able to learn from your model. And now that you've done all the hard work of kind of doing the product market fit, hopefully, you know, maybe we can find, you know, other organizations from, you know, different parts of the country to come learn, adapt, you know.
We got inspired from an organization that does much better work in Bangladesh called BRAC. And, you know, so I think each one from there, you adapt and you do that. And I think for a lot of people today, they feel, but I won't make a difference. Right. I would say whatever you do, you can make a difference.
Yeah. No, super inspiring. And I think, you know, for India to go anywhere, the inclusive development is absolutely critical, right? You know,
We can't be absolutely a first world country unless we solve the problem with the other 400, 500 million. But not only with grants.
Yes.
Not only with everything else that the government is doing, which is incredible.
Yeah.
Because if the mind is not aspirational, and if 50% of our population doesn't know what the definition of what do you want to do when you grow up for the kids there, which we take for granted here. But for there, if you ask them, you can't have just 5 career choices. You need 50 career choices. So I think aspiration level is a very soft and important factor and for that part of the country.
And the focus on livelihood, you know, plays a big role in that. Changing gear, Ronnie, I think last time I was meeting you, you were sharing that, you know, some people play golf for their free time. You make movies in your free time. So this is, you know, something you stayed with, again, you know, for 40 plus years, you know, a big part of the entertainment industry in the country. You've done, you know, defining things in that space. But maybe let's start, you know, more... What inspires you? Like, you know, how do you approach a new movie project? I mean, you have so much going on. So both, you know, what inspires to find time?
Today is very different than what it was when I ran it professionally and as a business. Because they do a lot of things that you have to do. But today, I think it's about stories I would like to tell. Because if it's a hobby, it's like the golf course. You choose your own tools and who you want to play with and who you want to play at which golf course would be. So I think it's about the stories that one wants to tell. So... And I think the partners that one wants works to, or the directors that one wants
to. So these stories come to you, or you go out and find the stories today?
I think that it's a mix of both today, because I've been in the industry and sector enough. But it's also with the clarity of what one wants to do in a particular thing. So when we did a, you know, Uri surgical strike, or right now we did a biopic on Sam Manning's show, and we've done a lot in the direct OTT space.
Yeah.
I think the right mix and match, it's always had a, it's had a, a definition, because I think brands are created either where you're superstardom and super commercially successful. And brands are not created if you're totally niche and want to talk only with very limited social messages. Yes. So I think the ability for being a little hatke, but also being true to what one wants to do is, I think I have the luxury to do it at this stage, and that's what I'm doing.
So you have the creative freedom and you can just pick the project that you want to, you know.
Totally creative.
Right. And just going back to, you know, your UTV days, you know, in those, I think it was the most professionally run setup that the country has seen. In the past, when entertainment industry was highly unorganized and concentrated on a few individuals.
Yeah.
And but you kind of came in a very professional, you know, approach, which later on, I think other people have also tried to do. But what was, you know, just in those days, how did you think about that, you know, building an organization as opposed to like very...
Most of the things I would say, which I tell people today when they're talking about, oh, but do I need to upgrade myself? And I said, you don't have a choice in your career. I would say I didn't have a choice. I wanted to build a B2C company.
Yeah.
For the first 5-7 years, it was a B2B company, UTV, where we were doing things for other people. Yeah. And the only reason for that is we had no funds. So when you don't have funds, you can't run a B2C business. You have to start with cost plus. But the minute we did have, and we had some investors and credibility, we wanted to move to a B2C model. And you can't create a brand in media unless you're on the big screen, whether you like it or not. Because today, we're not talking about our 10 broadcast channels or Bindas or some of the incredibly breakout programs we did called Emotion Atyachar that established a channel where MTV was a cult at one stage. But we're not talking about that because it's still television, but movies is big.
Yeah.
So I think the movies part was a no choice if one wanted to build a brand.
Yeah.
The first 5 movies we did were complete disasters. So I think everyone told us we should get
5 movies.
Yeah, consecutively 5 movies. So it takes a lot to just dig your heels and say, I don't have a choice in the matter. But I think the good part was I was the outsider. And I think that helped because that allowed you to look at it and look at things in a very different manner. Because if you can't beat them, join them doesn't work. Then you look at it very differently. I couldn't do what some of the other people in the industry have been doing so brilliantly and well and capturing the thought process. And I didn't come from the manner born. That allowed us to therefore do a breakout then and do movies like Swadesh, after which we called our foundation Swadesh Foundation, or Laksh, or Rang De Basanti, or Barfi.
Yeah, these are all like category-defining movies. I mean, you know,
the same. Yeah, and small ones like A Wednesday or, you know, Khosla Ka Khosla. So at that stage, we could do a lot more things at that particular point in time and experiment without being experimental.
And if you compare, you know, your days of running UTV, where you're dealing with a lot of creative professionals, you know, all with probably some sense of entitlement and egos versus, you know, let's say Upgrade, which is in a very different zone. What did it require to be a, you know, leader in that environment where just so many different type of people who come at, you know, very, very different, you know, vantage point?
I think you need to be a good catalyst, which means you need to be a good listener. And I think you need to be genuine about your intents of what you want to do. And you're not threatening, because if I'm a producer that wants to be a director, then I'm going to get my roles a little mixed up. But I think we always wanted to be the person who built and brought things together and be the catalyst role. So once everyone knows that's the role, then you need to talk sense, right? You can't talk. You can't just be one more. So you have to bring something more to the table than just money. And I think that's systematically what we did. A little bit of creative prowess, a little bit of the right cat, a little bit of sensibility in what we want to do, a little bit of corporatization. So we sprinkle all of that together. And I don't think it happened overnight. It took some time. Credibility took 5, 7, 8 years. As I said, our first 5 movies were a complete disaster. So most people would have written that off. So we were not starting from zero. We were starting from -5.
That part is, you know, every time here is today, you know, we are here, you know, I mean, you have so many outstanding successes that you look back, but, you know, all the failure that comes through, you know, that is, no matter how many times one repeat, you know, it still is pretty staggering to see, because it's for somebody who wants to do something new, knowing that I'm going to go through 5 failure over the next 10 years, it's just, you know, unthinkable.
And I'll give you a very relatable example to you, because we started Home Shopping Network in the country before anyone else. And it was called Tele Shopping Network, called TSN. We had bought time on Doordarshan, and our first hit product was a chapati maker. And that was early days. And then I went to HSN in the US and wanted to do tie-ups and all of that. And then the Draper and Bill Draper came in and invested, and then we moved into the digital space. But after 7-8 years, I think it was very early days at that stage. And if you ask me today, you can be a pioneer, but if you miss time being a pioneer, then you're before your time.
That's right.
And I think at that stage, postal code, ability to pay, touch and feel was hugely, and I think you can, you know, reflect on that when you're looking at companies that were built later on. if I stayed the course for another 10 years,
yeah.
I think I could have been 10x of Flipkart. But it's irrelevant because in that 10 years, I could have been broke and I could have been running away from this country from
it. Fair. So there are parallels of being too early also. Yeah, and right,
absolutely.
Yeah. Right.
And but I want to tell you, so when people look at exits, on one side, taking a hard call that you're before your time is equally tough.
Right. Correct.
Because, and that's where we miss out on because, and then we start saying, if only.
Yeah.
I have no qualms in my mind that if only I'd stuck it out, Kelly Shopping Network could have been bigger
than
all the e-commerce players today because I would have been broken between.
Right. No, absolutely right. You know, I think hindsight is, you know, is good from an intellectual perspective, but in but taking a decision based on what you know, and also, you know, exiting, you know, when some, because when you close something, then you can try something else.
Correct.
So sometimes just staying at something for 20 years may sound very heroic,
absolutely.
But so many other opportunities, you know, pass you by. Just having spent, you know, so much time in the creative world, does it allow you to be a different type of, you know, business leader when you're doing something like, you know?
I think so.
Yeah?
I think so. I think it's a very strong point, and I do think so. I think at the stage that, that one is today, in my mind that would circle, I would always look at the disruptive sense. I think disruptive comes from being creative in many ways. So I think you break it up into different protoplasms and molecules in life when you look at things.
Yeah, looking at things you've done, this one quote I came across about Steve Jobs, actually, I really like, you know, I think Larry Ellison said he had the mind of an engineer and heart of an artist. Which shows, you know, the product that he has created, right? So in some ways, you know, probably that's an advantage that you have, right?
Unfortunately, I don't have the credentials on the engineer part, but on the creative, yes, and maybe business would be the second one. So I think that's a different comment.
Yeah, and I mean,
but creative actually does. It makes an incredible difference on how you look at every single non-creative problem also and how to solve them.
And I think by all accounts, I think, you know, building a business, you know, especially when heavily tech-enabled, it's more of an engineering mindset because you're still, you know, putting a lot of parts together, fitting them and making the different kind of equation, but you're trying to, you know, make it work. But
the only way I would, because you brought up that point, it's a very relevant point. The creative process is one of improvisation.
Right.
And therefore, and the other, what I would call the engineering process is a lot more set.
Right, fair.
And there's a lot more process. And I'm not saying there's, there's good.
Right.
But because you're in the non-linear world of creativity, your ability to innovate and your ability to introspect is very, very different.
Yeah. I think, you know, I mean, everything, Ronnie, you've done, I think, super inspiring. You're still going very strong. I think I'm pretty sure you have a lot of interesting project up your sleeve for, you know, coming years.
But hopefully, I don't have projects up my sleeve. I think now it's the depth.
Right.
There's a lot to be done at Swadesh. Mm-hmm. There's a lot to be done in Upware.
Right.
And I think if I can continue to tell stories in RSVP.
I'm pretty sure. I think
Pretty much the dashboard is set.
You have the independence, you have the, you know, energy, and you really enjoy doing, and you're creating massive impact. You know, all your projects are very directly, including the movies, you're, I mean, the recent movies. Ones, they're also like creating impact at a very different scale, you know. So I think you've found that zone. I think you've gone through your struggles, you know, having your successes, but you're able to channel all of that, you know, intellectual prowess and resources into really making, you know, serious impact, which is super inspiring, you know. I'm very thankful to you, Ronnie, for taking your time.
It's really good. Thank you for all the work, because I think we covered such a wide range of topics today. Thanks for your breadth of...
I did the easy part. You actually have done all this in over the last 40 plus years. So it was easy for me to cover. But thanks so much.
Thank you very much. And I hope it connects with your
audience. I'm sure people will be inspired. They will have a lot of clear takeaways.
Yeah.
And those, you know, 3 minutes of actionable three things as well that people will be able to implement in their life. Thank you.
Thank you.
At Sparks, we aim to bring to you stories of exponential impact. We share in-depth analysis of what goes behind success stories. If you find our conversations interesting, you can join us by subscribing to our YouTube channel. You can also listen to Sparks on Spotify, Apple Podcast, or any other audio platform of your choice. If you have any suggestions on who we should invite or what topics we need to cover, just let us know in the comments. We are always listening, looking for ways to improve, and keep getting better as we go along.